So this is the second talk in the series, the retreat on selfing and non-self. And in this talk, I'd like to get closer to mindfulness as a power, we talked about yesterday, and really begin to unpack mindful awareness and what it might do to the constructions that we make around the world, and about ourselves. And it's just a fact that pretty well from the moment we're born with this kind of beautiful empty space, and then the mind begins to fill up like a huge storehouse. And any child is pretty well desperate to learn what this world is. And you can't say to a small child, stop, stop, stop. No. It's full of pain, trouble, difficulty, suffering, and finally death. So, just don't. But the child will, never mind what we say, and we are the result of constantly constructing a world. And what we're busy doing, more or less, from birth to death, is we're in the construction business. And we construct worlds, including the big one of me, and then we find ourselves inside the constructions that we make. And that's painful. We do rather stupid thing, like a builder that builds a kind of sealed room and realizes he's built himself into it. Life is free. Life is infinite. Life is boundless. Life is not a construction. It cannot be. But we can't see that. We can only see the constructions that we make and that we build. The mivnim, the definitions, the descriptions, the needs. And it's painful and difficult. And just think about what's happening now in the Middle East. It's just going to pieces. And you can see the way the constructions create huge amounts of suffering and pain and death. And war, constructions that they are the enemy, and I want to kill them that support that leader, or that group, or that religious stream, or that tribe. And that's a construction in the mind that constructs an enemy, and then goes out and kills them. And we make the best of it. But it's a little bit like that we're inside the prison, spending our time rearranging the furniture, getting more comfortable furniture from IKEA, and feeling, oh, we've got a little bit more comfortable now, and kind of trying to ignore the fact that we're rearranging the furniture inside the prison. And we need to cut through all of that. And what does it? There is a sweet little image from the Buddhist text about a king who is in his castle, but he's lonely and totally imprisoned in this huge castle. He imagines he rules the whole kingdom, but actually he's sitting in his castle, miserable, locked in, inside his walls. Feels a little bit like you know who, me and you. But there's a small window high up in the wall. And through this window, a bird flies. And it brings a message. And the message is in its two wings of the bird that allow it to fly. And the two wings are, one wing is mindfulness, and the second wing is calmness. And this is the message that the bird brings to the king. So I want to focus on mindfulness. I'll say two more words about calmness now, and then leave it. We talked about it yesterday. Calmness, concentration, steadiness is active and is passive. The active side of calmness is an actual intention to calm down, to slow down, to cool down. And it can be, and it's often encouraged by the Buddhist teaching, that you can actually use a breath to actively calm down the mind-body system. Breathing in, I calm the mind. Breathing out, I cool the mind. Breathing in, I calm the body. Breathing out, I let go. I release. Breathing in, I calm myself. Breathing out, I release. This is in the Anapanasati Sutta. This is in many texts. And it's an active side. And we can do it if we're walking in nature. I calm my mind and body. Sitting down, I calm my mind and body. And then there is the passive side, which is allowing calmness simply to grow as we do less, as we chase less goals and issues and stories, and we find that the mind calms down a bit just by being here, and we enjoy that. And it's good to appreciate a calmness that arises by a sense of not needing to change things too much, by not needing to run after anything. And that's the passive side. Appreciating settling down into the present moment. So they are both really helpful as one wing of the bird. The other wing is mindfulness. And here, mindfulness is given a huge importance in the Dharma teaching. And the Buddha said it would simply take you all the way to total awakening. Although I have to say, he said that about all sorts of other things too. But let's say that mindfulness is, of all the qualities, powers, what's called the factors of awakening, mindfulness is a leading one. I think he said it about many different qualities because there's something about the Buddhist teaching which is holographic. That if you go far enough and deep enough into any one piece of the teaching, you're going to find it all there. It's all packed inside, like Russian dolls. It's all packed inside itself. So even something like speech, there is a teacher and courses you can take in the world on insight dialogue. And insight dialogue is using speech to create awakening. Because speech leads to wise speech leads to awakening, leads to seeing, leads to knowing, leads to awareness of yourself and the other, and so on, so on, so on. So any part of the Buddhist teaching actually can take you all the way if you really go all the way with it. But mindfulness is the, I would say, the number one. And the key to mindfulness is that it is unconstructed awareness as much as we can. It doesn't support construction, it supports deconstruction. It's sometimes called naked awareness because it sees things as they are rather than as we construct them or imagine them to be. And because of that, it is a nakedness. It takes off the clothes that we dress up life in. Like we dress, children dress up their dolls as this and that and that and that and this. And that's what we do with ourselves. We dress ourselves up as an accountant, as a Stephen, as an Alex, as a Sahar, and we dressed up. But actually, mindfulness undresses us and undresses the world. So it's fundamentally deconstructing. It takes things to pieces. And it's not so important what we do that with. The breath and the body is fine. If we deconstruct the breath and the body, we find that we are living inside a magical kingdom in which anything happens, and the body is not just a body, my body that I need to fix now and then, and if it hurts I give it a paracetamol, Acamol, in order to shut it up, and as long as I don't have a headache, I don't even know I've got a head. It's a magical kingdom, our body. So we start with breath and body, and it also breath and body can more or less, we don't really need to go further than that. It's all right to stay with breath and body. But of course, it's also fine to explore other dimensions. And one dimension that I think is particularly helpful to us is a dimension of sound. And sounds are interesting because they are less specific. They are less exact. And we can't really locate them that easily. The sounds are all over. And so they naturally tend to extend our awareness into space as we follow sound or as we allow sound. And so they're more subtle in a way. And so they can pull us out, if we follow sound, into a more spacious awareness. They have a different quality from the sense of touch, which is the body sense, or the sense of seeing, which is the eyes. But I want to talk a couple more minutes about working with the body, again encouraging you to see the body as a landscape, as an adventure. Imagine you're going to discover a new country that you've never been there before. Your first trip to India. When someone says, you're going to have to go to India, you have to go to India. And all the, what's you going through your mind when you get on the plane? Gosh, where am I going? What will happen to me there? I remember in the 60s, I hitchhiked to India from London, just getting tramping all the way to India and back again. What an adventure it was. I had many adventures on the way. But there's this India, which was the goal, which was the interest, which was the excitement, and which was the unknown. So imagine our bodies like that, because it is. What's a breath? What's the difference between a short breath and a long breath? What's the breath when we feel it in our fingers? How does the breath calm a painful place in the body? How does that work? What's the dialogue between the breath and a pain in the body? How do they talk to each other? What is the experience of comfort or discomfort in the body? How is that? And how am I with that? And how can I let that go when I relax a piece of the body that's tense and tight? And what actually happens when I relax it? And who relaxes it? And what is it that I relax? And what's the process of change that happens to a part of the body that relaxes when I relax it? I have a long relationship with my eyes. My eyes seem to be the part of my body that tense up quite easily. I've got glasses, I read a lot, or I used to read a lot, and I've always had an issue with tension around the eyes. And then one day my good friend, Israel, who teaches eye exercises, and I'm not a very good student, I have to say. I've still got my glasses because it's just I wasn't a good student of his. But he did tell me something which was very beautiful. He said, when you give attention to your eyes and you relax the muscles and the tension around the eyes, it is the giving of love. See it as love. And see how much your eyes need your love. An extraordinarily beautiful thing to say. We can see that and feel it with the intimate awareness that we have with this mind-body field. So mindfulness gives importance to senses, to what's coming in the senses, to what we do with it, and how we use material from the senses to construct the world. It's not just the senses, because we are busy constructing the world. So, for example, we're standing in the queue, waiting for our turn to take food, and we find ourselves at the back of the queue, and along can come our usual narrative or construction, I'm always the last. Everyone else is before me. Life is I'm a failure. I don't make it in life. Construction, construction. We also know our constructions. They are part of the picture of the mind-body field. And it can go to any difficult mind states that we have by mindfully and intimately and kindly paying attention to a mind state as it arises and as it passes. We deconstruct that mind state. It has less power over us because it is seen. It's not just working unconsciously, controlling us. It is seen. Like the demon is fully exposed, and we realize, okay, I see you. Often, mind states and emotions are built of small elements. Feeling that passes, a thought, like the one I mentioned, of being at the end of the queue, a taste, a sight. And we forget that we build things, we construct. This is the constructions that we make from individual bricks and stones and pieces of wood. We build a building. But one of the ways which we can deconstruct is to see that this building is made of bricks and stones and pieces of wood. We think it's a big building that's imprisoning us. Actually, it's just made of small things. And we will talk about that later. What's interesting is that when something is really seen in the present moment, it becomes basically timeless. An event needs, for it to be seen as an event, a construction, it needs to have a beginning and a middle and an end. It needs to arrive, it needs to be there, and it needs to go. And it has in it that sense of time. But mindfulness doesn't really have any time in it, because it's immediate awareness of what's happening as it happens. There is no sense of a track. I'm following it as it rises and it stays and it goes. It's just a sound. It's just a thought. It's just a word. It's just a feeling. It's just a pain in the body. It has no existence in time. Is just seen as it is in this moment. And the next moment is another moment. And the experience is a bit different. So there's something very beautifully timeless. And by the way, in timelessness, There is no birth and no death. And sometimes people find, well, I just can't understand when the Buddha is talking about deathless, no death. What does he mean? But he means something like this, that death is for that you need a birth. And birth and death are ways we look at things, including we look at ourselves in time. I have a quote, a Zen quote about this. In this moment, there is nothing which comes to be. In this moment, there is nothing which ceases to be. So in this moment, there is no birth and death to be brought to an end that we don't want. And thus, the absolute peace is this present moment. And although it's just this moment, there is no limit to this moment. And this is the source of endless delight. Mindfulness shows us appearances. that phenomena that come, arise, are there. Stories, thoughts. We don't need to do anything with any of these materials that come and arise. We don't need to build anything out of them. We don't need to believe them. So, mindfulness, we call it naked, but it isn't bare. In other words, nothing. Sometimes in the early days of the Dharma practice, there were books written, and the early teachers, I think coming from the Burmese model of practice, talked about bare attention, that what the practice is bare attention, naked, bare. But it is not quite true. Mindfulness isn't bare, meaning nothing. It's actually very full. But it's not blank, and it's not hazy, and it's not drifting along. It has energy. It is sharp like a knife. Real mindfulness is not about blankness or dreaminess. It's power of mind. It's not distracted and associative, running from thought to thought and just lost in thinking. It's not disconnected. And as I said, it's also non-conceptual. And that's sometimes difficult because the mind is so quick to make a concept around everything that it thinks and that we know, to make a conclusion. We read too many books, we've been to too many years of university and school, we think that everything needs to be explained and understood and described. And the concepts are so dominant in our life. And mindfulness is more of a direct knowing, immediate knowing. There's a story in the Buddhist text about somebody that came to the Buddha and said, I'm basically an idiot. I don't have any intelligence, they tell me. They threw me out of every school. And is there hope for me? Can I join your Sangha? Is there hope for me? And the Buddha said, yeah, sure. Come and join. But I can't do anything. I can't even read texts. I can't understand anything. The Buddha said, never mind. Clean shoes. Clean the shoes of all the monks. So he started in the Buddhist Sangha, cleaning shoes every day, cleaning shoes of all the monks, cleaning, 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 cleaning. After he'd been there quite some time, the Buddha said to him, okay, as you clean, imagine that you are cleaning yourself. not just the shoes. And he cleaned, and then at a certain point he got it, and he became an arhant, awakened person. As he was cleaning the shoes one day, he the penny dropped, the asimon dropped, and he suddenly realized, I'm cleaning the constructions. Just like the quote from William Blake, clean the doors of perception. Clean what's coming in. Clean all the constructions and the issues and so on. I'm cleaning myself as I clean the shoes. And not only the shoes, but me myself will be shining and bright and free. Mindfulness is a key to understanding and cutting through self, because one of the main constructions is the self, is me. And mindfulness can show us that really there's just phenomena happening and there's no one in charge. There's no boss. And that's an extraordinary revelation that can come directly through mindfulness. Who's the boss? A thought arises. Am I the boss of that thought? Did I invite that thought? Did I tell that thought, now is your turn? Or another thought, now go away. We can't do it. The thought comes because it wants. And difficult thought, it would be great if we can tell any thought that we like, we can decide to be the boss and say, this one not, and this one yes. A judgmental, angry, difficult, painful thought, no, I won't have that one. And a wonderful, blissful, joyful thought that tastes of best cup of coffee, I want that one. There's nothing we can do there. We're not in charge. And mindfulness will show us that. Mindfulness is about exploration. And exploration is places that I don't yet know. And it's quite helpful to push the boundary and look at what's going on in our mind-body into places we don't yet know. Places of the unknown. Places that have no explanation. Places that have question. Such as the fundamental question, who am I? And what's going on? And what's the world that I see? Let mindfulness go there, to those places, not as concept, but as mindfulness. Mindfulness is direct knowing. It's clear, immediate knowing. Like the just sense, I know. That's not a explanation. It's just a knowing. Like, you know the touch of your hands right now. That doesn't need explanation. Doesn't need any intermediate. It's direct. And the same with everything in mindfulness. Exploring places that I don't yet know. Being intimate. Unpacking, undoing the knots, being close, appreciating places in us that we haven't discovered yet, that we're not sure about, that we've been avoiding because it's a bit painful, places that are under the radar, that are subtle, that are in the unconscious, even all those demons that sort of lurk around under the water. Go there too. They're all right. They're us. They're part of the construction. There is a Sufi story that I like to tell about a man who's locked in a prison. He's a Muslim. And he writes a letter to his friend who's outside the prison. And he says, please, please, I'm desperate to get out of this prison. Send me a gun or a screwdriver or a hammer so I can break the lock and open the door. He waited and waited, and after a while, a parcel arrived. And he was very excited. He opened the parcel with enthusiasm, and it was a prayer carpet. And he was really upset. No gun, no hammer, no screwdriver, nothing to open the lock. A prayer carpet, what can I do with that? He threw it in the corner of the cell and became miserable and depressed. But in his boredom and depression, he thought, well, okay, I might as well use the prayer carpet. I'm a Muslim after all. I'll start to pray. So 5 times a day, he spread the carpet and the floor of his cell and prayed to Allah. And he prayed, and this went on for a while. And then one day, when he was close and his nose was touching the carpet more or less, and he was very close to the carpet, it's the first time he noticed the pattern, the design that was woven into the carpet. And he realized that the design that was woven into the carpet was the design of the lock that was shutting him in. And on the basis of that, he could open the lock and be free. And it's a story how our freedom comes under the radar. If we see under, our freedom is there. Our freedom of wildness, things that are not in our control, things that are not predictable and even understood, but are the wild life. We had a retreat I forget exactly when, but there is an Arab village nearby, and it was a Friday, and the muezzin was giving a talk from the tower, and the speakers were really, really strong. The whole building here was shaking with an intent, and everybody had different reactions. It was like a huge disturbance to some people. Some people built it into a rather nervous story of, what's he saying? He must be saying things against us, and I'm frightened. And other people said, oh, it's, including myself, yeah, it's a bit strange, but it's still a Dhamma talk of some kind. A bit loud. But it was definitely an issue that came in the middle of the quiet of meditation, this huge disturbance. And it just made us feel, well, you know, we can't really expect, even in a retreat where we come to be quiet, we can't expect things. Things arise. The unexpected comes. Life is wild and uncontrollable. And another aspect of mindfulness is that as we pay more attention to just the senses as they are, that itself is enough to deconstruct the constructions that we are making, because the senses as they arrive, are in the present moment, and we don't need to do anything with them. And that's the way we unlink. And I mentioned earlier about oil and water. We unlink, we make a gap between what is coming in and what we do with it. The automatic building that we make out of the phenomena, the raw material that comes into the consciousness. And so if we can let go of the need to build out of every sense impression that arises, we're there in a free space already. We feel the touch of the grass. We don't need to make a comment on how it feels good, it doesn't feel good. This is indoor, this is not indoor. The grass should be cut, it should be watered. I don't like this very much. I do like this very much. I'm not a good walker. They're better meditators than me. From just a touch of the grass. It's just touch of the grass. It's just sound of the birds. That's enough to deconstruct the self. Because you don't need a self just to listen to the sound of the birds. There's a very classic sutta about this called the Bahiya Sutta, which is a favorite of all the non-dual practitioners. And it's basically quite a nice sutta because it gives a sense of the power and directness and simplicity of the Buddha's teaching. And this sutta is about a man, Bahiya, who was a yogi, and he was living in the south of India, and he was a yogi practicing ascetism. He just wore clothes made of the bark of trees, and he was regarded by all the villagers as a great yogi and an awakened person, and they used to come to him for blessings and so on. I have to say in brackets that when I spent my first year in India in 1975, and I spent a year on the banks of the Ganges in Varanasi, and there were loads of real wild yogis there in every kind of postures and all the beads and the hair and the tridents and the perfumes and lots of villagers coming to them for blessings all the time and touching them and bowing to them. And it's like an unbelievable drama. And if you believed that these guys were awakened, they seemed to be so wild and amazing and powerful and sometimes charismatic with fire in their eyes. And everybody believed them to be awakened. And now I'm kind of a little bit wiser, but at that time I was also pretty well believing it. although actually the guy that took me out of that was one of the yogis there, Naked Baba, who had his spot on the banks of the Ganges. And I went to him and said, "So show me awakening." He said, "Of course I can do this." And he said, you wait and you see. You watch me." I said, "All right, okay." And he was a very big guy with a big chest, and he was naked, right? So. And he took two or three breaths and sort of filled himself up like that. And then he rolled his eyes into his head and sort of stopped. And then 1 minute later, he kind of collapsed. And he said, "You see?" So, luckily, the Bahiya, he had an intuition that maybe things were not quite as they seemed to be, and that he wasn't as enlightened as he thought he was. Maybe he had an intuition, and he asked the gods, "Tell me, am I awakened?" And he had a dream where a great god came to him and said, "Sorry, you're absolutely not. You didn't get there at all." And so in the dream he said, "Where do I go? What do I do?" And the god said, "Well, there's only one man that can help you. And that's the Buddha, and he's in North India, and you have to go there." And he walked 3,000 miles, 5,000 kilometers to the north of India. And as the story says, he didn't stop on the way, never more than one night in any one place. He didn't stop. He kind of ran as fast as he could to the north of India. And when he got to the place where the Buddha was teaching, he found the Buddha going around in the village collecting food with the other monks and his bowl. And this is a ritual once a day that the monks and the Buddha, they only ate one meal a day, and this was quite holy that they would go and collect food from the villagers. The villagers would give them. So he said, "I'm desperate to have teaching. You must teach me now. What is the teaching for awakening?" And the Buddha said, "Sorry, I'm in the middle of collecting my food for the day." And he said, "No, no, I have to know now, right now." And the Buddha said, "No, I'm sorry, it's the wrong time. Go back to where we're sitting, and wait for me there. And in the afternoon, I will give you any answer you want." "No, no, no, it must be now." And the Buddha said, "Well, if you really insist, since you asked me three times, I can give you a key, but it's short. It will have to be short because I'm in the middle of collecting my alms." And this is what the Buddha said. "In the scene, what is seen, there is only the seen. In the heard, there is only the heard. In what is sensed, there is only the sensed." What is sensed? Through the senses. "In the cognized," what is arising in the mind, "there is only the cognized. And so you should see that indeed there is no thing here." There's no thing here. There is just seen, heard, cognized. No thing here. This, Bahia, is how you should train yourself. And when, Bahia, there is for you, in the seen, only the seen, in the heard, only what is heard, in the sensed, only the sensed, and in the known, the cognized, only the cognized, the known, and you see that there is no thing here, you will therefore see that indeed there is no thing there, the world, no thing there. As you see that there is no thing there, you will see that you are therefore located neither in the world of this, nor in the world of that, nor in any place between the two. And this alone is the end of suffering. Really, really clear and simple. And by the way, look at the difference between the teaching he gave at the same time as all these wild yogis that say, you know, you need multiple rebirths, you need endless ascetism, you need Brahmins, you need this, you need... So simple, so direct, and it's the mark of the Buddhist teaching, how simple and direct and cutting through the constructions. And he's saying, in the moment of seeing or hearing the senses, in that moment of senses, there is just sensing. And in where there's just sensing, there isn't a self that's needed for that here. And there isn't a world that's needed as a construction there. You are not needed, or you are not in the sensed, or in the what is coming in. You are not needed to hear the sound of the birds. You don't need to be with the birds, with the sound of the birds. It doesn't confirm you. It just says the birds are singing. And that's the mindfulness. The mindfulness by itself will deconstruct the self. There is a concept, a language in the Dharma called Yoniso Manasikara. And it's the kind of wisdom that arises from mindfulness and from the wise use of attention. Because mindfulness is using attention instead of to construct things, self and the world, to deconstruct. And it's interesting because this is a word that has in it a quality of female, yoni, female. And I think it, to me, in the image in the Kabbalah, or in the quality in the Kabbalah of Bina, it feels more like Bina in the Tree of Life, in the Sfirot in Kabbalah. It's a shift in the way of looking rather than in analytic understanding. And it has in it ethics. And this might be a surprise for you that I mentioned this, but it is an understanding that mindfulness is not bare and empty. Mindfulness is full. And that if we are mindful, we are also mindful of what's important to look at and what's helpful to look at. And even what we said just before, to limit our looking to the senses is wisdom, but is also what we decide is helpful. The instructions he gave to Bahia are what is helpful to Bahia. Mindfulness is a kind of a guardian. It helps us choose what is helpful to see, to pay attention to. It prevents the misuse of thought and of the mind. And mindfulness itself has an ethical dimension. What is wholesome? What is helpful? For example, we mentioned calmness. Mindfulness can help us to be calm. Mindfulness can help us to be less afraid, less insecure, less judgmental, less irritated with the world, less against, more supportive. Mindfulness has in it kindness. Our sense of allowing things to be as they are, without blame, without criticism and anger and chains of reactivity. Mindfulness protects us. There is a story from the Hindu tradition about two acrobats, a father and a son. I first heard this in one of the Goenka retreats I did. The Goenka likes to tell this story. And the father and the son are doing acrobatic performance, where the father is holding a bamboo pole, and the son climbs up on top of the bamboo pole and stands on top of it. And the father says to the son, "Okay, let's do this act. I will hold a pole, you climb up, I will pay attention to you, you will pay attention to me, and by paying attention to each other, we will be safe, we will look after each other." And the son said, "No, no, Dad, you got it wrong. You pay attention and look after yourself. I need to pay attention and look after myself. And you looking after yourself and me looking after myself, we automatically will protect each other." Different switch around. That's the way that mindful awareness that we have is an ethical act. It's helpful to us and helpful to everyone else. And a final word. Mindfulness has in it fruits. As we let go of the dominance of constructions in our life, and especially the construction called in the middle, the king in the castle, the me that sits in the middle of my life and seems to control everything. As we get a little bit loose from that, there are experiences that arise by themselves that we don't so much need to look for them. We don't need to hunt for them. And experiences of release, experiences of joy. We don't need to hunt for joy. Joy arises naturally when we loosen the constructions which imprison us, when we see that they're not really solid and they're not really imprisoning us and the doors are open. Joy simply arises. Joy comes when the touch of truth, when we see things more clearly as they are, when we walk on the grass and we don't need to make a whole series of thoughts and reactions and responses and ideas and problems and issues around walking on the grass. The walking on the grass then creates joy in a way that we don't control and we don't need to worry about. The joy comes from truth, from seeing intimately into life. It comes by itself. It comes from a sense of okayness. I'm okay with the world. The world and me, the world is known. We're together. There is magic. And we feel it through this. We can't ask for it. We can't demand it. But we can feel it when the constructions are gradually deconstructed and coming to pieces. We feel a spaciousness inside and outside. Feel the world is unpredictable, unknown, surprising, magical, uncontrollable, wild, beautiful. And we dance with that. I think I'll stop at that point. Thank you.